Hey friends, as we were in our production meetings for this episode, we decided that it would be best for my partner in crime, Josh Gott, to host the episode. So I'll be back later with some insights. Until then, here's Josh.
If you were to name the most successful recording artists in history, there's one artist whose name would almost certainly appear on that list. Billy Joel is a success by any standard, unless your standard is number one hits. His grand total? 3. Kind of hard to believe, for all his popularity and despite over 160 million albums sold, only 3 chart toppers? Yet to this day, he sells out stadiums, serenading fans with beloved track after beloved track, many of which aren't those 3 number one singles. Most fans prefer the slow burn tracks, the ones you won't hear on the radio, like Scenes from an Italian Restaurant or She's Got a Way. Joel is a bit of an oddity in the music world. Most artists focus on writing hits, secretly knowing that the rest of the album is kind of filler material. But Joel's filler tracks are among some of his most beloved songs. There's something about his writing that hits us different. There's a quality to them that's hard to explain. And maybe, just maybe, it's because if there's one thing Billy Joel hates most, it's writing songs. He's notorious for putting it off because it's just so difficult for him. He once told Howard Stern, "Sometimes I look at the piano and it's this big black beast with 88 teeth that wants to bite my fingers off." For Joel, writing music did not come in a sudden euphoric burst of creativity. It was slow. It was painful. It was sort of like carving marble. The end results may be brilliant, but the process is a real grind. And the truth is, if you're someone who wants to create enduring work, work that hits different and has a quality that's hard to explain, some days you're going to have to carve marble too. And on today's show, we're going to look at a few things you can do to make it a whole lot easier when it feels like you're facing down your own big black beast with 88 teeth. This is Daily Creative, a podcast for creative pros who want to be brave, focused, and brilliant. Welcome to the show. Richard Feynman was a once-in-a-generation mind. He was awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1965, along with Schwinger and Tominaga, for their fundamental work in quantum electrodynamics. His work has far-reaching impact, transforming a variety of fields from physics to computer science to medicine to manufacturing, just to name a few. He's one of the most influential physicists of the 20th century. His insights are too numerous to count, most of which I can barely pronounce, let alone understand. Feynman was dealing with a level of complexity that's hard to grasp. Yet, somehow, that didn't stop him from coming up with brilliant idea after brilliant idea. Ozan Varol, author of Awaken Your Genius and an intellectual heavyweight in his own right, gives us a window into Feynman's process.
He's sitting in the Cornell cafeteria one day and watching someone throw plates in the air. And he watches the plates as the plate goes up. It wobbles, and he notices that the Cornell medallion on the plate is rotating faster than the plate itself. So he gets really curious, and he's, oh, I'm going to just, for fun, work out the equations of these wobbles in the plates. And one of his colleagues comes up to him and says, what are you doing? And he's, I'm just playing around with these wobbling plates and trying to work out the equations. And the colleague says, or asks him, what are you doing that for? And Feynman says, no reason at all. I'm just curious. And that leads him to then pursue or ask questions about how electron orbits wobble in relativity. And that in turn leads him to do the work that he eventually wins the Nobel Prize for. And looking back, he says, there would have been no Nobel Prize if I hadn't, just for fun, sat down to work out the equations of those wobbling plates.
Just playing around led to a Nobel Prize. And it wasn't but a couple of years later, and only about 150 miles east of Cornell, where there was another series of experiments being conducted that would reveal a lot about the process of crafting brilliant ideas. In upstate New York, there was a small town called Woodstock, largely known for playing host to the iconic music festival by the same name in the summer of 1969. But a couple of years earlier, something else was cooking just north of Woodstock, in the basement of a modest, pink-sided home affectionately known as Big Pink. It was a hideaway of sorts for a group of friends and longtime bandmates, Rick Danko, Garth Hudson, Richard Manuel, Levon Helm, and Robbie Robertson. The Band. A nickname that became their stage name after years of being the consummate backing band, first to Canadian rockabilly sensation Ronnie Hawkins, and then for a slightly more recognizable folk singer named Bob Dylan, who just a few years earlier had decided to trade in his acoustic for an electric and set the music world in an uproar. The tour of Dylan and the Band is notorious for its less-than-warm reception by audiences heartbroken that their beloved oracle and voice of a generation had plugged in and sold out. Often the booing was so loud that the only recourse Bob and the Band had was to turn everything up to 11. By the way, next time someone gives you harsh feedback, just remember, one of the greatest songwriters of all time spent an entire tour getting booed mercilessly. It was a watershed moment in history, but it also took its toll. So in 1967, Dylan found himself in Woodstock, recovering from a motorcycle accident. Also needing a respite, the Band discovered Big Pink for rent and moved in just up the road. What happened next would be a masterclass in making hard ideas easy. Garth Hudson, the only formally trained musician of the bunch, was also technically savvy. So savvy, he was able to assemble an in-home recording setup at a time when that was utterly unheard of. No one did that. If you wanted to record, you booked studio time. And studio time meant union rules, and union rules meant a running meter, rigid hours, and mandatory breaks, regardless of when inspiration struck. The Band wanted freedom to explore, and creating their own recording studio in their basement gave them just that, free from the pressures of formal studio time. Dylan caught wind of their setup and joined in. Together, they tried new styles and new expressions. They penned sentimental songs. They wrote silly songs and experimented with everything in between. Numerous times, Dylan would sit down, clank out some lyrics, and then immediately pull the paper from the typewriter and head to the basement where they'd work up an arrangement. Over 100 songs were written during that summer. It was completely uninhibited and wildly prolific. And more importantly, all caught on tape. Today, those recordings are commonly known as the basement tapes, and the early bootlegs were wildly influential. At a time when rock and roll was on a runaway train to psychedelica, the basement tapes opened up a new avenue, roots rock, and a genre most commonly known today as Americana. What was it that made this summer of 67 so productive? Well, at first blush, you might say it was time. They had nothing but time on their hands. But having more time is hardly a guarantee that ideas flow. In fact, it's often the opposite. I think the real difference maker was this. It's one part of the story I kind of forgot to mention. They were recording with no intent to publish. The tape was rolling, but they had no plans to ever release the songs. They freed themselves from any sense of responsibility for the success or failure of any track. There were no label executives looking over their shoulders asking, "Where's the hits?" Like Richard Feynman and the Wobbling Plates, they were just playing around. Practicality has its place in the creative process, but introducing it too early is why coming up with ideas often feels so difficult.
I'll give you an example of how this works in real life with a client. Like when I go in and I teach teams how to generate ideas, which is something that I've done very often, we'll use a method that forces them to think outside of the normal boundaries. And typically, and I'll explain the method in a minute, but typically when we do this, we start with a prototype problem, one that everybody's familiar with. And usually the prototype problem that I use is, how can we make commercial air travel fun? Because that's a pain point that everybody experiences, right? So we do this exercise where we force people to think in random ways about the problem. And we always come back with these just incredible ideas, right? These like amazing, like, what if we made the floor into an LED screen and put cameras on the bottom so you could see what's underneath the airplane, right? Or what if we made the plane invisible and you could see outside? It was like you're flying Wonder Woman's invisible jet, right? Or like, what if we had adult-only flights where there's like an open bar, you know, and you could just sort of like go to the back of the plane and like talk with people and whatever, especially on long-haul flights. Like they come up with all these really cool ideas. And then I say, okay, great, that's great. Now let's talk about a specific problem that your managers gave me. And we're going to use the same technique to talk about a problem for your organization. And so we sit down and we start doing the same method. And immediately at all the tables in the room, I start hearing, well, but you know, finance would never go for that. Or, well, that's not really practical. Or, well, that sort of violates one of our government regulations. Or, you know, and it's like immediately we start shutting down all of these ideas. We're not even willing to entertain the idea because we have so many filters in our head about what is and what isn't possible. And the funny thing is, if I did that commercial air travel thing with Delta Airlines, I guarantee you I would have the exact same experience, right? LED screens, are you crazy? We're not putting LED screens on the floor. Do you know what that costs? You know what happens when one LED goes out? Because that's just the way we're hardwired.
Next time you catch yourself trying to come up with fresh ideas and saying to yourself, man, this is really hard, try infusing some irresponsibility into your process. Just start playing around with ideas that you never intend to publish, but make sure Garth Hudson's in the background capturing it all on tape. And if you simply can't bring yourself to do that, this is where trusted collaborators can be invaluable. Ask them to help you jumpstart your imagination, but be clear with them that you want them to think impractically. To harken back to last week's episode, let them know what kind of conversation you need to have with them. No self-editing, no filters. Free them from any responsibility or obligation to execute on the final concept. The more outrageous, the better.
We can always rein those back and find a more practical version of that idea, but it's really hard to go from the most practical idea in the world to something that's actually unique and valuable.
So unburdening yourself of the shackles of practicality can certainly go a long way toward making it easier to dial up the flow of ideas. But let's be honest, even that sometimes isn't enough. I don't know about you, but I've had plenty of days where I felt like I physically couldn't get my body to come up with anything new and interesting. Todd says there's actually a reason for that.
Our problem as creative pros is that our ambitions fight our biology. Your mind is a complex neural network. When you have an experience, when you have an insight, a connection is made between neurons in your brain, to oversimplify things. The more you have that experience or you get a certain reward, like a certain aha or an insight or whatever, that network, that connection gets reinforced. Part of the reason your brain functions this way is it's designed to help you predict the future, to keep you out of trouble, to keep you safe. The novelty function in your brain is really designed to help you identify, hey, something's not right here. So something's out of sorts. I need to pay attention to this because that could be a saber-toothed tiger hiding in the bushes waiting to ambush me. And so your mind is almost your worst enemy when it comes to creativity and novelty, because the novelty function really in our brain is something that we almost like try to avoid. And yet, ironically, the value that we create is founded upon novelty. It's founded upon our ability to uniquely meet the needs of the marketplace. This is that constant tension we feel. And so what happens typically is we'll go a little bit outside of the expected. We'll go a little bit novel because it's novel enough to look like we're adding value, but not so novel. And so we just iterate on the last thing we did and we stay very close to the middle.
Crazy, isn't it? We're literally fighting ourselves when it comes time to come up with new ideas. So if we're ever going to reach our ambitions, we have to overcome our biology. We need tools, weapons of self-instruction that can hijack our brains, force them out of the familiar and into the novel. And I know just the tool. Imagivating.
The pandemic hit and I was locked in this loft in my apartment and I just decided I'd start trying to do this in real time. And so I got a Twitch account and I started streaming with this name Imagivate. And the idea was, let's get together and let's come up with terrible ideas.
That's Troy Hitch, an agency veteran and one of the most brilliant people you'll ever meet. Funny, talented, insanely imaginative, good at everything, great hair. Yeah, I hate him too. Troy's always cooking something up in his creative kitchen. Imagivate was one such idea that I got to experience firsthand. When I first got the invite, I did a double take. Wait, you want us to come up with terrible ideas?
And I don't mean bad ideas. I mean terrible ideas, ideas that would make people cringe, ideas that seem so outlandish, it's insane. So every morning from like 8:30 a.m. to 9 a.m., 30 minutes, we'd have the chat would load up with people, and then I would give a prompt and I would ask for terrible ideas to solve that problem. And then chat, people would fire away some of the most terrible ideas I've ever heard. One of the ideas that, just to give the listeners an understanding of what a really terrible idea is, we talked about, hey, how do you solve the problem of the really long line at Chick-fil-A? And one of the ideas that came out of it was build a smaller Chick-fil-A in the parking lot of the Chick-fil-A so that at some point you can get some Chick-fil-A while you're waiting to get your Chick-fil-A, right? So that was the way that Imagivate would kind of unlock thinking patterns. Now, what's so great though is that the terrible ideas almost inevitably lead to really amazing breakthrough ideas. And that's what we would do. We would riff on those things and I'd push and see if we could get it to that place where terrible becomes terrific. And we often did.
It's true. I can't tell you how frequently we'd find ourselves at the end of an Imagivate session staring at an idea that, despite our best efforts to make it terrible, it defied all odds. And that's because underneath the art of imagivating lies a powerful principle.
About 10 years ago, I created a presentation. This was a presentation about how to get to creative ideas. And I spun this tale of a fictitious company that I had started called Teleportly. And Teleportly is a travel disruptor. It is perceived teleportation that is achieved by administering experimental pharmaceuticals with travelers, sealing them in hermetically sealed containment system called the Funcophagus, which monitors their biometrics. They are shipped like cargo on a modified Airbus 380 to their destination and then revived with an experimental pharmaceutical. And as far as they know, no time has passed. They have been teleported to their destination. And so I go through this whole presentation and I do it straight ahead. And many people are like, is this real? What is he talking about? And then I sort of pay it off by saying, if somebody had told you 10 years ago to go stand out on a street corner and you're going to press this button on your phone and a car is going to pull up, it's not a taxi, it's like somebody's Honda Civic, and you're going to get into the back seat, you're not going to exchange any conversation with the driver, they're going to take you exactly to where you're going, they're going to know, you're going to get out, you're not going to pay them, and then you'll go on your merry way. People would have been like, you're crazy. I would never do that. Well, you might say the same thing about Teleportly now, right? But great ideas come from terrible ideas.
When you find yourself drawing a blank, the ideas just won't flow. Perhaps the problem is you're aiming at the wrong target. You need to set your sights much lower. Start shooting for terrible. Stop ideating and start imagivating.
One of the phrases that I use a lot, because I still do imagivate in like the professional setting. When I'm facilitating different sessions, I'll bring in terrible idea sessions as well. And the phrase that I use is getting to the right solution the wrong way. And there is something really disarming and relieving, right? Like I don't have to come up with the answer. I need to come up with an answer. And actually, the more different that it is, the better, right? If I come into a company and they're trying to figure out a new product or they're trying to figure out how to appeal to a new consumer, but they're bringing their same convention of, you know, brand and product and stuff to try to solve this new problem, they're just going to struggle, you know? And so that idea of doing it the wrong way is liberating, but it's also where you unlock new pathways. And yeah, it seems to work really well.
If imagivating sounds exactly like the kind of tool you or your team needs and you'd like help from a master imagivator, you can hit Troy up at troy@bigfatbrain.io.
I'm pretty choiceful about what I work on, but I would love to hear from anybody about where they might find terrible ideas as a remedy to what ails them right now.
Okay, so let's say you've tried getting a little irresponsible. Maybe you've even taken a crack at imagivating, yet still, juices aren't flowing. What then? Well, you may want to grab a pen and paper because Todd is about to introduce you to your new best friend, the Personal Idea Pad, a tool he built to solve this very problem. If you want, you can download a version at ideapad.me.
The idea behind this, and by the way, you don't have to have this specific tool to do it. It's something you can do just with a sheet of paper if you want. I'll talk you through how to do it right now. You're going to start at the center of a sheet of paper with the problem. And then typically what I do is there are kind of four areas that I typically suggest. People start with what I call starter words. One of the starter words is an assumption. So one word, an assumption that you make about that problem. One of them is an aspiration. What is one word that describes what it will look like when this problem is solved? So what's the aspiration? Affinity is, what is one word that is similar to the problem you're trying to solve? Like maybe that describes another problem that's similar to that. So we have assumptions, we have aspirations, we have affinities, and then we have attributes. So attributes is, what is one word that you think of when you think of this problem? Okay, what's one attribute of this problem? Now, what you're gonna do is you're gonna start with one of those four starter words. And you're just going to say, okay, let's say that the word is apple, okay? And if you're doing this in a group, it's really fun, right? So the word is apple. And then I'll ask you, Josh, makes me think of?
Computers.
Okay. So if you write down computers, makes me think of chips. Makes you think of?
Dip.
Makes me think of tobacco. Makes you think of?
Cigarettes.
Makes me think of smoke. Makes you think of?
Fire truck.
Makes me think of alarm. Makes you think of
sleep.
Okay. All we're doing is like a giant mind map of free associated words. Then you go to the next starter word and you do the same thing with that one. And you go to the next starter word. You do the same thing with that one. The next starter word, you do the same thing with that one. And now you've got a sheet full of words. And what's great about the personal idea pad, the sheet that we created for this, is there are numbers and letters associated with the boxes you put these words in. So you can randomly choose letters and numbers and randomly mix up words. You know, cigarette and alarm, how does that help us? How does that have anything to do with the problem we're solving? How could we come up with an idea using those two words to help us solve the problem, right? So basically you're randomly smashing a couple of concepts, a couple of words together and seeing, is there anything that that does that that sparks in my brain to help me solve the problem we're trying to solve? Listen, maybe the answer is no. Great, choose two more words. Then great, choose two more words, right? And what we're doing is we're just trying to smash random concepts together, use them to try to solve the problem that's in front of us. My encouragement to people is, when you're stuck on a problem, don't just sit there and stare at the problem and don't ask, what did we do last time? And what did the client expect? And what's in the brief and whatever. Randomize your thinking, explore what's in your brain and try to force some of those connections. It's hard work. It is hard work to be creative, especially the more you do this, the harder it gets sometimes to get to those initial insights. The myth we believe is that, well, there are some people who just have it and some people just don't. That's not true. Any of us can get there if we're willing to do the work. And creativity is work. Make no mistake about it.
Todd's right. Creativity is hard, no matter how you slice it. But hopefully, you have a few more tools than you did 20 minutes ago to make it at least a little easier. Things like irresponsibility, creativity without consequences. It can give us the permission slip we need to cross lines that we otherwise might not. Or imaginating, focusing on terrible ideas as a means of surfacing terrific ones. It can free us from the constant self-editing we do when we feel the pressure to be brilliant. Or the personal idea pad, a simple worksheet for forcing connections. It can spark new ideas lurking just beyond your grasp. On the days when you've got a bad case of the Billy Joels, don't be discouraged. Great ideas are out there, and once you get out of your own way, you'll find them.
If you'd like to hear the full interviews with Ozan Varol and Troy Hitch, you can do so in the Daily Creative app at dailycreative.app. And there you'll also find the entire podcast archives with hundreds of episodes, daily episodes, prompts that will help you be brave, focused, and brilliant, courses, and much, much more. You can subscribe at dailycreative.app. Daily Creative is produced by Joshua Gott. He's our chief story architect and also hosted today's episode. My name is Todd Henry. Thanks for listening.